Hades Town came to prominence on Broadway this past year, but it was first produced in 2006. N.A.S. Mitchell wrote it before any prominent person seriously suggested building a wall dividing the United States from Mexico. I'll come back to that wall, which is inescapably what must come to mind nowadays when we hear that song. But first I want to look together at some other ones. The kinds of walls I think of whenever I hear this, and that I've been able to perceive more clearly thanks to Mitchell's art. What is a wall? Why do we build them? To shield ourselves? A wall can shut some things out, threats, people. A wall can shut some people in. Walls are prisons and protectors. They're always double-sided, though it is not always easy to know which is inside and which is outside, what is being walled in and what is being walled out. Greg Brown, he of the deep bass voice, plays the god of wealth, but his children are not wealthy. They are poor. And so the war of which they sing is a war of the poor against the poor. Elsewhere in the opera, others sing that he is not a loving father, but a mean old boss, demanding and harsh. He teaches his children that there is not enough to go around. Scarcity rules. And so they must protect what little they have from the others who want what they have got. This is a story we hear as well. A story very relevant to this day when we celebrate labor, when we hope that the work that we all do or have done will be honored and will be enough to support us. We hear the story that there is not enough to go around and we must protect what we have from others who would take it away. And it's a lie. This story. There is enough on this planet to feed us all, to shelter us all, to give us what we need and more than what we need. It's just that so much is hoarded, guarded behind walls, the walls of bank safes and gated communities and locked doors and stock portfolios. And these walls are built, high and thick, in the words of the opera, by not only the richest among us, but by millions of us who accept the lie. One reason, I think, that we accept the lies and the walls, we don't know they're there. We sense them, but we don't perceive them for what they are, until a prophet like Ambedkar or Mitchell shows them to us, which is the first stage of liberation. So Mitchell shows us something else by using, as she does, the Greek myths of Orpheus and Eurydice, of Persephone and Hades. She shows us what the Greeks identified thousands of years ago, that the god of wealth who's singing here, he is the god as well of the dead. He's Hades. And his people, his children, are the dead. Elsewhere in the music, it's explained that the wall they're building is the River Styx. Or rather, the River Styx is actually a wall, one of cinder bricks and razor wire built by the dead over the millennia. What a brilliant turn. I don't know what the ancient Greeks meant by it. I have some ideas what Anais Mitchell means by it, to make the god of wealth the Lord also over all the dead. Now, people do not, as a rule, pound at the gate to enter the world of the dead. Looking for photos that Heather might put on our website for today's service, I came across one that's of a formidable wall around a cemetery. And the photographer wryly titled it, Safe Place to be Dead. So why are the dead, the citizens of Hadestown, building the wall? They say it is to shut others out, but in fact, it only shuts them. So in light of that, maybe we should consider, why do we build the walls we build? The walls about money, about property and prosperity. Do they protect us? Do they imprison us? That we are imprisoned, at least to some extent, by our fear of others taking what we have, there is no question. I'd look at all the money that we spend on locks and security systems, on car alarms and monitor cameras. The billions spent alone on police forces and guards to protect property from those who, for the most part, only steal because they can't support themselves with an honest job. Imagine what we could do with that money if we didn't spend it to put up these walls. But that's just one aspect of the whole question. I'm really thinking of a deeper kind of imprisonment. One of the saddest conversations I've had in my years here in Palo Alto, years ago now, was with a teenager whose primary life goal was to become rich enough to live in Palo Alto, or someplace a lot like it. I asked her why that was important to her, and she said that people with less money than that were miserable. She just wanted to be happy, and she didn't think it was possible to be happy anywhere else. She could not imagine being happy with anything less than a Palo Alto income, which, as we know, is a much higher bar for her generation than it was a generation before, or a generation before that. I don't think she saw the wall there. But I did, speaking to this young woman, so young, whose world ought to be opening up before her, but whose goal wasn't leaving her a lot of choices in this life. Who would you rather be as you go into the work world? Someone who can be well and happy with $80,000 a year, or someone who needs four times that? Which one is more free? A wall that shuts someone out always shuts somebody in as well. One of our highest, thickest walls is the one preventing connection across class lines. Rich, middle class, or poor, we live in so much fear and mistrust created by our myth that there is simply not enough, that prosperity is a zero-sum game. And I mean it's a myth, in the sense of a lie, not in the sense of an ancient story that might illuminate, as in the Greek myth of Hades, but a lie. In the song, the enemy is poverty, but it quickly becomes apparent that the enemy is actually the poor. And so people are divided from people. What do we have that they should want? The people of Hadestown ask. They want what we have got, so we'd better grip it tightly. So let's look at that zero-sum myth. The fact is that spreading the wealth of a community more evenly, a community such as a nation or a city or the whole world, creates more prosperity for everyone. This is amply demonstrated, but we live as if it were not true. We're pitted against one another, as if by a god. Just looking around our news, our neighborhoods, just recently, from for-profit so-called rideshare drivers who keep their prices competitive by bearing the cost of employment that riders don't want to or can't pay, To hardworking folks who make their dollars stretch by shopping at bargain places, whose products are made by hardworking folks who are paid poverty wages. We find ourselves saying soon that some people must live in poverty, even starve, in order for others to have enough. You know, those parents shopping at Walmart, they just can't keep their kids in jeans and sneakers unless the people who made the jeans and sneakers have not enough to feed themselves and their children wherever they are. That myth, some people must suffer in order for others to have enough. If we hear that in our heads, I would say that's a moment to stop and ask some deeper questions. Maybe that's why we seldom say it out loud. We just live it. And let's remember that the higher price tag on expensive items doesn't mean that the makers are receiving a living wage, not at all. Someone is making money from that markup, but it isn't the little boy weaving the Persian rug, or the woman in Malaysia sewing luxury clothes for the US upscale market. And so we live in little islands of affluence protected by police. Think what happens if someone who looks poor wanders through a wealthy neighborhood. Or we live on islands of poverty, and we bar the door against those who are even poorer so that their desperation frightens us. If resonating in our heads, it's no surprise that we think we need a wall to keep us free. But it's not true. Good news, it's not true. We would be freer if everyone had enough. We here in the United States, we were freer when incomes were more equitable, when union wages and strong social programs lifted the floor, and much higher taxes than we have now on the wealthy lowered the ceiling. We had more security, we had less fear. Our heyday of equality, the 1950s and 60s, was also this country's heyday of prosperity. It was far from equal. There was still poverty, and the poverty pooled among people of color, among women and children, with wealth pooling among cisgender, heterosexual white men who were married, then as now. But it was more equal and prosperous for all. More equal than we've been before or since, and a happier time economically for all. One myth told about times like that is that the prosperity enabled the equality, the harsh boss urging us to keep building that wall, to hold on to what we've got, to not spread it around. Tells us that it's only in good times that we can afford to spread the wealth around, and when times get tough, we can't do that. But that's backwards. The greater equality of that era is one of the major factors that created the prosperity. Greater equality creates more happiness. A typical study of developed nations shows, here's a quote from the researcher, every single time income inequality decreased between two time points, inequality decreased, the percentage of people responding that they're very happy went up. And every time income inequality increased, the percentage of very happy responses went down. In other words, the researcher continues, although economic growth was steady and strong during the entire period that we were studying, the evenness of the income distribution was fluctuating, and happiness was inversely related to income inequality. And a study of poorer developing nations found that it is the even distribution of economic growth across a population that accounts for greater happiness. In contrast, when economic growth is concentrated among a small portion of the nation's elite, it does not lead to greater life satisfaction. We get greater happiness from equality and also greater freedom. Those who find satisfaction in their lives in something other than having high income are better problem solvers, studies show. They deal with life's challenges better. That makes them freer to take things on, to make choices, and they report a greater sense of autonomy than those who are fixated on income, getting and having and holding on to more and more. So equality makes us free, more free than inequality. The even better news is that the power to create that equality is in our own hands. This system wasn't created by the gods. We're not pawns in their hands, the way the humans are in Greek mythology. We can create equality if we choose to build it, instead of building walls that divide us and imprison us. Our centering words are an interesting for those of us who are afraid. We may not be the richest of the rich. We may not be hoarding vast sums, but we worry. And we're attached to, you know, being able to buy a car and a house, a college education. Those words from Carl Schurz, who, as I said, came here around the time of the Civil War from Germany, he spoke of the necessity of extending freedom to all if we are to be free ourselves. He says there is no other way. And I'm aware here that quoting Schurz is ironic, because although he opposed slavery and joined the Republican Party upon his immigration to the United States and became a general in the Union Army, after the Civil War, when President Grant tried to enact strong protections of freed people's rights, right to vote, to own property, etc., Schurz opposed him so strongly that he helped create a new opposition party, the Liberal Republicans, which didn't last very long. Clearly, Schurz's belief in freedom failed him at that crucial moment. If those measures that President Grant wanted had been put into place, the brutal legacy of slavery would almost certainly have been mitigated. But Schurz, like most of us, proclaimed ideals beyond what he could actually put into practice. We say we want freedom and equality. I believe we really do. But we're also afraid. And so we fail to see the ways we live what Ambedkar called a life of contradictions. As he urged his country as it began its new life as a republic, if we can admit these contradictions, we will experience a kind of equality that has eluded us thus far. And then perhaps the prosperity and happiness and freedom that come with it. We will remove not only the political barriers between us, but also the social and economic ones. And we will find what the scholars have shown in our own country's history, have demonstrated, that these barriers stand not only between us and our neighbors, but between each one of us and the ideals we seek. But first we have to see the walls and what they're trying to hide. Sometimes the walls are so obvious that they help us to see what's going on elsewhere. The most visible barrier of our political moment, the border wall, illustrates what we're dealing with. Poverty that drives people from their homelands to a foreign country where they don't know the language or the ways. For every person who freely chooses to immigrate, there are many more who feel that they just have no choice. Who have no choice. And instead of making common cause with them, seeing our common goals, We as a country are putting a physical barrier up to match the economic, social, and political ones. But the barrier between US and American and foreigner has always been permeable. Foreigners become US Americans. That's how I and almost all of you came to be here. And the real walls aren't made of cinder bricks and razor wire, nor a river, nor guards. They're within. And we can build them or take them down. There's a joke about two British college students who are talking about their areas of research. One shares what she is studying and then asks the other. He says, "I'm researching the secret of the persistence of the class system in the United States." And she says in surprise, "I didn't know there was a class system in the United States." He says, "Yes, it turns out that that's the secret." We can't fight what we can't see. But bring down the walls, and we can see what has been keeping us from each other. And then we can reach our hands across. The Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies, one of our 20th century prophets of justice, asked, "What can we do to stretch our hearts enough to lose their littleness? Here we are, all of us, all upon this planet, bound together in a common destiny, living our lives between the briefness of the daylight and the dark. Kindred in this, each lighted by the same precarious, flickering flame of life," he asks, "how does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? How strange and foolish are these walls of separation that divide us." What can we do to stretch our hearts enough to lose their littleness? What can we do to create more equality, to lower the walls between us? I believe we know the answer. We know what to do to broaden our hearts and to extend a hand across the space where there were once walls. We know. So let us go forth and do it.